Hello, welcome back to another exciting episode of the Open UK Summer of Security series. I'm your host, Matt Yankovic, and we're here to talk about all of the interesting security issues, challenges, and trends in the open source space. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the next episode in the Open UK's Summer of Security series. I'm your host, Matt Yankovic, the head of open source strategy at Percona. And today we're joined by Sonia Moisette from Sneak. Hi, Sonia. How are you?
Hi, everyone. I'm good. Thank you. I'm Sonia. I'm a senior security advocate at Sneak. I'm also a lifelong traveler who lived in the Middle East, North Africa, and Asia. I was always looking for new challenges, so I made a career change from international business consulting to engineering, self-taught entirely, and to cybersecurity now that I'm based in London, in the UK. I'm passionate about open source, DevSecOps, computing, cloud computing. I'm also a GitHub star and OpenUK ambassador. I'm also a mentor for cybersecurity cohorts, so Caps Lock and Cyber Girls based in Africa. I've also founded two initiatives, Epic Women in Cyber and Epic Women in Tech, just to showcase women in the industry. I'm a public speaker and tech advocate in general. So yeah, really happy to be here and having those discussions with you.
Oh, great. And you've actually done quite a bit in not only the security space, but, you know, in the open source space, in the community space. I love the passion of being able to help so many different organizations with so many different, you know, activities and help people get better. I mean, that's one of the things that I've often admired about the open source space is not only the inclusivity, but the willingness for people to help, you know, one another and help people get started.
Yeah, I think it's really important.
Sonia.
Because I've actually changed from business consulting to engineering and then cybersecurity, and I always thought that giving back to the community was something important. So that's why now that I have the opportunity and also using those different stream and organization, I could give back to the community and try to, just give more to the open source security space.
Now, we know that Sneak is in this security space. So your job as someone who's out there evangelizing, talking about security issues, you must, have a lot of, people who come up to you and ask you about, all kinds of security related topics. Maybe start with telling us about some of those things that you're hearing. What are people concerned about? What are some of the challenges that exist today?
Sure. So usually the biggest security challenge that they have is they don't know what they have within their code base. I like taking actually the iceberg image. So basically at the tip of the iceberg, this is the code base that you have. So the proprietary codes would be 20%, the code that you're actually write in-house. But actually below this proprietary code, you have all the open source dependencies, which could potentially include risk and vulnerabilities. But also you have a bigger attack surface containing the containers and also the infrastructure as codes, because you need to deploy all of these applications and projects. And usually developers don't have enough visibility around those because they usually focus on the code that they write within internally in their organization. So having tools that give them that visibility clearly, and also do it in automatically an automated fashion, help them usually within their development cycle. So that's basically one of their biggest challenges, because they don't know about those open source dependencies and vulnerabilities that could lie within their code base.
Well, that's one of those things that I think from a modern development standpoint, we're so used to having so much free access, especially in the open source space, to libraries, you know, different tools. It's very easy to grab a component and then just plug it in. But that component might rely on five other components, which may rely on five other components, which may rely on five other components. So you end up having a very detailed, deep, recursive tree structure of code that's very difficult to sometimes get full visibility to.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this is fine if they want to add the dependencies because they don't want to reinvent the wheel. They don't have time because they have pressure around production. They need to ship quickly to production. But what I would recommend is usually to do some research around the package that you would like to implement within your code base. So there are tools for that to give you that visibility. So for example, at Snyk, we have the advisor website where you can actually enter the name of the package and they will give you following several dimensions. So this could be the maintenance, if there's still maintainers around the package, the number of stars that you have, the number of vulnerabilities, all of those dimensions that gives you the health visibility and package for the dependency. This gives you actually more confidence to implement that package. And if you feel that the score is not high enough or it will bring vulnerabilities within your code base, you can still look for alternatives. So you'll have different packages that'll probably do the same thing, but have a higher scoring around those dimensions.
And so a lot of times when we talk about security and we talk about this particular issue, this is potentially kind of segmented into those components that have vulnerabilities or maybe CVEs or things that can be exploited. But I've often seen that there's also this subset of security issues that are caused really by lack of knowledge. Like, so, or, you know, people get these tools, they don't know how to set them up. Maybe they don't keep them updated. Maybe they, you know, leave things by default. So I think that there's this double, you know, whammy where you talk about, you know, people who have, you know, vulnerabilities from unpatched code or they don't understand. But then we also have this vulnerabilities that are left open because people don't understand how to deploy or potentially use that software. And that's something that I've seen quite a bit on. I don't know. Have you seen that as well?
Yeah, and I think also for the maintainers of those open source projects, sometimes they don't have the tools to actually flag those vulnerabilities within their projects. So for example, if we take the project hosted on GitHub, what I would recommend is to have a look at the GitHub marketplace where you have applications to set up even a basic CI/CD pipeline, but they will help you to harden your project and set up even a basic pipeline and scan your dependencies or scan your codes, just give you that visibility. And the good news is all of these applications are free for open source projects and public repos, so they can leverage those applications to give them that visibility. And also they could apply best practices for their projects. So for example, enable 2FA if they have several maintainers or on their accounts. They can also protect their main branches, so they don't have the main branch to be deleted by accidents. Like those kinds of like best practices just to be implemented in the project will help them having those baseline that could give them visibility. Because we've seen actually maintainers that have been compromised because of, for example, there was one incident in 2018 around the FlatStream and EventStream package where the maintainer has been social engineered, which is quite surprising within GitHub, but I'd like to explain how it happened. So basically, because he was maintaining by himself the project, so obviously he was looking for other contributors, and the hacker had time actually to go through the issues and seen one of the messages. So basically it was around adding a feature, and if one contributor was adding that feature, it would the maintainer would merge it through the code base, which is fine because that's the principle of open source. We need to contribute, and that's cool. But what happened is that attacker actually took some time to build up some cosmetic changes. So he pushed changes on CSS, on the readme file, just to build up that trust with the maintainer. And then at the end of the day, he actually got access, right access to the repo. And then he pushed, obviously, a malicious payload. And it was targeting at that time a Bitcoin wallet called Copay. But yeah, this was kind of like social engineering maintainers. So yeah, as I was saying, having those safeguards around your project could actually decrease the risk. So for example, don't give write access directly to a contributor. Yeah, those kind of things.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting case because that reminds me of the case of the University of Minnesota where they tried to push packages in or changes into the Linux kernel to see if they could get them through. you know, which was another interesting case on that, where, you know, again, you're trying to follow the process and you might be building up a reputation within that community, and, you know, have a long-term goal of doing something nefarious. But it also reminds me of, you know, it's not only those malicious actors, it's sometimes the product owners themselves, right? You look at the, you know, Faker and Colors JavaScript libraries, and you had, you know, the gentleman who was in charge of that purposefully, you know, introduced something that broke websites, you know, as kind of a form of, you know, his protest because, you know, he didn't feel like he was getting enough recognition. So I think that there's a couple of interesting attack vectors there that people don't necessarily think about, but I think that as maintainers, you are potentially rather susceptible.
It's quite common.
So how you know?
For example, for attackers, actually, it's quite cheap for them to target an open source project because they know it will target 100,000 millions actually of user for this specific package. So it's better for them to actually spend some time trying to find an entry point in that specific package because they know it's been used by several projects instead of targeting something else. So yeah, that's just actually a good entry attack path for them.
So and like how do you, you know, like what can you do in that sort of a situation where maybe you have a really strong open source project and you have someone who's contributing code, but you suspect that maybe they're not, you know, doing things that, you know, are for the best of the project. Like, are there tools or other things that you can do to potentially watch what they're trying to push and see if there's really a person behind that or if it's someone that's a bit more shadowy?
Yeah, I would recommend to have in your pipeline tools around software composition analysis to flag if there's any vulnerability within the package, or even static analysis testing tool also to see the diff and if there's any vulnerable code that has been pushed to your project. So having those actually points in the, within your pipeline gives you a better visibility. At least they give you notifications and alerts if something goes wrong and you're alerted, and you can still push block the pull requests. So usually what I would recommend is I say to protect the main branch, but if you add some step, so basically when you scroll down to the pull request, you can see some steps. So you can add a step for the software composition analysis, you can add a step for the SAS tool and others. And if there's one who comes back with a red cross, this will actually block the merge, and you'll have actually to have a look and see what's wrong on the code that has been pushed. So this could be a way to actually prevent pushing directly to production. So having those kind of workflows behind that pushing directly to master.
So, you know, it's interesting. So a lot of people, you know, there's two camps, right? There's people who absolutely love open source and they bought into it. There's still a group, it's shrinking, who aren't fans of open source. And they often point to, see, open source is less secure. Do you believe that? Is open source inherently less secure because people can do this, they have access to the code? Or is it more secure? Because I think on the open source side, the thing that we've heard before is, more eyes mean more opportunity to catch something before it moves into, you know, an actual production space.
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, for a big project, like let's say Kubernetes, there's like thousands of contributors on it. We know that the project is secure. It's backed up by the CNCF. Projects that are backed up by the Linux Foundation, we know that there's actually safeguards and security pipelines integrated within these projects. So I think for those big projects, when there are hundreds and thousands of contributors, we would expect a different level of security, which would not be the case for smaller projects. And unfortunately, some of these smaller projects might be used by a lot of projects, a lot of applications. And this is probably where the organization needs to do some due diligence. So they shouldn't just pull out the open source and just inject it to their code base. They should actually use their own internal pipeline where they actually already have security tools and do the same workflow. Actually, if they integrate some components, they'll just have to use their CI/CD pipeline or security pipeline with different tools that they have, just to make sure they have to do their due diligence on their side as well.
So you mentioned, you know, like the size of the project, like Kubernetes, and I think, you know, just to clarify for those who are watching, listening, you're really talking about the size of the contributor base, not necessarily the size of or the deployment of the project, because certainly in the case of something like Log4j, for instance, has a very small contributor base, but a very large impact.
Yes, yeah. We've seen it in December last year for that specific project. And yeah, it was the case. As I said, there's like smaller projects where they do have fewer maintainers and they do have a large impact because they're implemented like for Log4Shell. They're implemented in the Java ecosystem, and we've seen the impact in that case. But as I mentioned, if the organization have, for example, SEA or a SAS tool, they could potentially flag that vulnerability. That will help actually to fix automatically those. So for example, Snyk actually released in their pipeline tools that actually flag the Log4Shell and help their customers, and also with their free trial, because you didn't need to actually have the paid version to flag those. Just using the free trial helped a lot of customers actually to flag the Log4Shell vulnerability. But having that tool, usually help on that side.
Well, what's funny with that particular tool is it was incorporated into a lot of services and a lot of other software that wasn't necessarily open, right? So you actually saw the impact of it far beyond the open source space. You started to learn how frequent that particular piece of software and how prevalent it was. I mean, because it showed up everywhere, right? Like, I mean, it was in proprietary software, it was in software as a service. And this is a weird spot, because when we talk about like security vulnerabilities, especially on the software side, we're generally talking or have a lot of focus. We talk a lot about, you know, we know the open source code, we can scan the code base, we can look for these things. But with the growth of as a service offerings, with a growth of, you know, like there's some proprietary offerings or things that aren't as open, you don't always know what's underneath the hood.
Yes, and I think also that goes to the importance of starting to have SBOM, so software bill of materials, just you have that visibility and list of dependencies that you have, and also not only dependencies, but also have the licenses and the patches, just to have this aggregate in one place with the SBOM. So regardless if it's open source or if it's proprietary, will help you actually having that visibility. So I think starting to create those documents can help the organizations.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that, you know, that's definitely something that I know like governments are looking at. How do we enforce this? I wonder how deep they'll go though, because, you know, as I mentioned, there's packages you use, and then there's packages your packages use, and there's packages your packages your packages use. And so as you get further down, you know, like I think that I don't know how deep the government, you know, or the regulations would force you to disclose, you know, because if you say like, you know, I use, you know, tool X happens to use another tool that uses another tool that uses Log4j, you know, like, would you still disclose it, or would the top disclosure then require someone to actually put the puzzle pieces together? It's an interesting question.
Yeah, so I think it's a good starting point to have those discussions, and it's good that the U.S. government actually are kicking off that issue around the having an SBOM for organizations, and I think nowadays probably. From the reports that I've seen around Snyk, Tidelift, and others, is 50% of organizations usually don't have that visibility. So starting with the SBOM and starting to have that security hygiene and listing all the dependencies and components that you have within your projects might help, hopefully, to have that visibility.
Yeah. No, and I mean, you know, it's something that it's a step in the right direction. I wonder how long it will take us to get to a place where we say this is reasonably solved. I mean, we're never going to solve it completely, but you know, I think reduction is the goal here, right? Defense in depths, because you know, there's going to be more than one place that people can come and, you know, potentially, you know, cause issues. And I think that not only the software bill of materials side has that, you know, component, because with that, you're not only talking about the software you're using, but also the versions, because a lot of times you're relying on, you know, software that has versions that are way out of date as well. And so it might be something that, yeah, the security vulnerability is fixed in version, you know, 1.2, but this one's stuck on version 1. And so how do you do that? And I think that's where, you know, the whole idea behind supply chain security has started to kind of pop up as well, which is, where are you getting your software from? And do you understand what's part of it? And it's funny, because back in the start of the open source movement, you know, everything was, you know, you either grabbed your source and you built it from source, which kind of went out of vogue with a lot of the enterprises. A lot of enterprises forced you to use like the Red Hat, you know, network or repositories, or, you know, something that was a paid for thing. And those were the quote unquote vetted and secure way to get your software. And then we kind of moved away from that, where everyone started downloading containers. People started grabbing, you know, code from GitHub. They started grabbing packages from GitHub. They started using alternative package managers. So it became this kind of somewhat controlled to chaos. And now we're looking at, how do we control it again?
Yeah, I think essentially one of the best practice that an organization could do is to have a centrally managed repo where they do have a list of already vetted approved open source components. In that case, it would be easier for the developers to know already which components they could use, because it has been vetted by the security team, has been through the whole process. Potentially, they had a security policy within the organization that could support that. And when they have a new component that developers would like to use, it'll go through the process only once, and then go to that centralized repo, and then they could use it for the other teams. So I think probably having this could be also a good start for organization to have that centralized repo of vetted components.
But what do you, so I've seen like Google, and you mentioned Tidelift, you know, there's other companies that are trying to also build these quote unquote certified or guaranteed or secure, right? I mean, I don't know what term to use necessarily for these, but they're really looking at, can they build their own repositories of kind of like, you know, confirmed open source. And I wonder if that helps or hurts, because, you know, then it's like, you know, organization one uses, you know, Google's, organization two uses Red Hat's, organization three uses Tidelift's, organization four uses the government's. Maybe there's government, you know, branded. Maybe there's the UK repositories and the US repositories and the Chinese repositories, right? Like, we could have a, you know, official repository per government at that rate.
Yeah, that's true. I guess for the organization, even if they don't use one standardized and they don't know where to start, even having one place where they actually centralize all their repos, and it makes sense for them to have that place of a better repos, because it's been through their pipeline and security policy and vetted by the security team, that could be a good starting point. And then if they want to reach some maturity level, they could have a look at some more like standardized framework or other centralized repo. That's usually one of the issue. We don't know which one we should follow. What is the standards? That always those discussion floating around. Instead of wasting time of like looking at which standards would be the best, just start somewhere. At least just start to have those security hygiene and best practices at least.
Yeah, and so, you know, when we talk about like, you know, some of those, we often get that, like, you know, those types of policies or that type of process requires a bit more like people and resources on the security side, but there's a lot of smaller organizations. What are some best practices smaller organizations could employ to not only secure their pipelines or their supply chains, but also make sure that they're securing, their systems on their own.
So usually what I like to do when I work in different workplaces is to actually educate, take some time to educate the developers, to let them know and give them real life examples, just to have the consequences of what could happen if you onboard some vulnerable open source components or other use cases. So having the developers within that security journey, also to make them understand what could be the consequences on the business. Because at the end of the day, we're all working on the same project or product. And also for them, it's always good to upskill and have like different point of view or just skills on that side. Usually I would say for the security team to spend some time to cater some security courses for the developers, and potentially have like a security champions program, because usually the security team, as you said, are smaller in organizations and compared to the number of engineers. So having those security champions where you can have those discussions, and also for them to organize, I don't know, lunch and learn sessions. You could do hack the box sessions, because usually developers like when you hack stuff in real life, just to demonstrate the attack. It makes more sense also to have those like hands-on labs. So having those discussions and those courses or sessions with the developers also helps in terms of like relationships with the security team, because they will see you as more consultant or enablers and not blocker. Because that's usually what's the main issue for organization, is the security team is seen as a blocker, always the department of saying no for everything. I mean, it's true.
You don't want to be that team, Nia. Yeah, you don't want to be no team.
So usually it's best to actually explain what's happening. Just be transparent with the tools that you're using. If you're implementing a new tool, just bring the developers with you during the point of the proof of concept. Onboard the developers, let them play with the tool, let them give you feedback, because they will be also the one using the tool at the end of the day. So just to have the developer on your side and also giving you feedback on the tools that you want to implement is also a good way to have that relationship with the developers. Because if it's a security team only driving that implementation of tools, and you just drop the tool at the end when you pass a procurement department, it's like, here you go, this is a new tool. And developers would be like, what is that tool? I don't want to use it. It doesn't make any sense. Why? What's the point?
Yeah.
You need to bring them along with the through that security journey.
Yeah, it's education and winning their hearts and minds, right? Yeah. So, letting them understand the why it's important, and making them part of it. Security isn't just about one team; it's about like the entire organization. So, how do you make them feel like it's part of it? And I think like the hack the box exercises are always good. I mean, one of the cool things a lot of companies do is red team, blue team exercises. So, let them participate in some of those. It could be fun, right? It's definitely going to be educational for sure. And so speaking of education though, so, we are entering, we're halfway through 2022, so we're almost to 2023. So as we go forward, what are you seeing as some of the bigger issues in the security landscape? Like, what are some of the trends or concerns that, you think people should be aware of?
Well, this year we've seen more around what we call protestware. So basically protestware is based on the geopolitics situation that we're in now. So you have different level of severity for that. It ranges from, for example, on the README file, you would have the maintainer who will put some, if they support their protests, they'll just put it on the README file. But it could range to higher severity with actually, depending on your location or your time zone, it will actually rewrite on disk your files. So basically if you're based in Russia, for example, and that your device is flagged as localized in Russia, they will actually overwrite all your files if you download this protestware malicious package. So we've seen this the first half of the of that year. So this could potentially be something for the maintainers to use that as a way to protest and show this to the open source community. That's something. This is based on our geopolitical situation at the moment. But I would say the situation that we're now with the open source with maintainers and contributors will probably actually continue, because it's based on the organization who potentially don't have a good understanding of what open source is, if they don't have the tools implemented within their pipeline. So if they don't have a software composition analysis, if they don't have a SAST tool or other tools that will flag those vulnerabilities, if they don't implement an SBOM actually to list all of those dependencies, this also will continuously be an issue this year and next year. So having initiatives like the US government to push to have that SBOM hopefully will trigger some discussion in other countries and have those potentially those discussion in Europe, in the UK, or in other part of the world.
Okay. Well, Sonia, I want to thank you for hanging out, sharing with us a little knowledge, you know, telling us where you think that the, you know, open source ecosystem is going to head in terms of security, and pointing out a few of the trends. Appreciate you hanging out with me today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For those who are interested, this has been the Open UK's Summer of Security series. You know, come back next week for another episode. We'd love to hear about how you feel this is going. Give us your feedback. Leave us some comments in the comment section. Thank you very much.